Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
I find that I'm drawn to art that somehow speaks of home, particularly when I'm nostalgic and homesick. So this painting, Tutu, is, and by the way, apparently the original is missing. Nobody knows where it is. It's this wonderful mystery about, you know, where is the original Tutu? And nobody knows. Benin Wong was very well known, very well respected. And so this particular painting, Tutu, the print, I think, hung on every wall of every middle class family in Eastern Nigeria when I was growing up. So I grew up with Tutu on the wall in the living room.
And it's a painting of a very beautiful looking woman wearing a headscarf and turning and looking almost over her shoulder sort of past the viewer.
Yes.
And there's an enigmatic kind
of
look in her
face. Yes, so there's just a beautiful sense of mystery about her. And it's also the kind of mystery that's, it's very compelling, but you can't quite penetrate. She keeps you away in a way. And growing up, I just love to stare at it. And now, for me, it just brings back, it's home.
So she was on your wall when you were growing
yes.
up?
Yes.
And if you went to a friend's house, she was there as well?
She was there.
Everywhere
yes.
you went?
Yes.
So who
yes.
was Tutu?
I think Tutu is said to have been a princess, a Yoruba princess, who apparently Benin Wong was very keen on and who sat for him. And it was particularly interesting at the time because it was a cross-cultural romance.
Yeah.
Tutu was Yoruba, Benin Wong was Igbo, and even that, I think, there's that tension I quite like. And I like to think, now that I know that story, that tension is in the painting. There's a sense of, I can never fully own, I can never fully sort of, you know.
Were they lovers?
I don't know.
So nobody knows the real story. There are a lot of mysteries.
Yes.
And rumours.
Yes.
And people imagining what this relationship might be.
Yes.
So that's the beauty of this painting, that you can read your own stories and your
yes.
imagination can run riot when you look at her.
Yes. She's regal. So she's, you can tell from the way she's dressed, the headgear, and even just the way she carries the sort of the straightness of her back. You can see the princess in her.
And what do we know about Benin Wong then? He died in 1994 and he was greatly influenced, I think, by a lot of Western artists, wasn't he?
He was. He's one of those artists, Nigerian artists, who there's sort of a, in some ways like the painting, I think there's a bit of mystery about him. People have different, you know, so you say the name Benin Wong, people have really interesting and different stories about him. And a story that I love is the story about how he would fast for days before he would sort of start painting. He was also a sculptor. And the story about how sometimes he would decide that this particular piece of art was not for sale. And so he's said to have sold a piece of art to an expatriate. And then the next day, suddenly decided, no, actually, I don't want to sell it. So he sort of ran off to the airport. The expatriate was about to board a flight. And he stopped the expatriate, gave him back his money and took back his art.
I've read that he, as I say, he was influenced by Western artists, Picasso he cites, and he reminds people that, of course, Picasso was greatly influenced at a certain point in his career by a lot of African art.
Yes.
And he says that, of course, nobody criticises Picasso for that, so why should he not, in turn, be looking at the Western canon?
Absolutely, and I think he makes a wonderful point about how being an African artist can often mean that people want you to do exactly what your ancestors did. So if you're not sort of copying bronze masks, then somehow you're not authentically African. And, you know, and I think that's a very good point. And also I love how he says that Picasso was influenced by his ancestors, by Benoît's ancestors.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's strange to then claim that he's being influenced by Picasso, because really, Picasso's influence came from his Benoît's ancestors, which I think is a fantastic point.
So you grew up with Tutu on your wall as a child. Is she still there with you now, or a different version of her?
She's still in my parents' house,
What about your house, or wherever you live?
No, I don't have Tutu. Actually, you know, now that you mention it, I'm going to get myself a Tutu. But there's a sense in which, because Tutu represents childhood for me, I kind of like the idea of when I go to visit my parents, Tutu is there.
And yet, the original painting is missing.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
I find that I'm drawn to art that somehow speaks of home, particularly when I'm nostalgic and homesick. So this painting, Tutu, is, and by the way, apparently the original is missing. Nobody knows where it is. It's this wonderful mystery about, you know, where is the original Tutu, and nobody knows. Benoît was very well known, very well respected. And so this particular painting, Tutu, the print, I think, hung on every wall of every middle-class family in Eastern Nigeria when I was growing up. So I grew up with Tutu on the wall in the living room.
And it's a painting of a very beautiful-looking woman wearing a headscarf and turning and looking almost over her shoulder sort of past the viewer.
Yes.
And there's an enigmatic kind
of
look in her
face. Yes, so there's just a beautiful sense of mystery about her. And it's also the kind of mystery that's, it's very compelling, but you can't quite penetrate. She keeps you away in a way. And growing up, I just love to stare at it. And now, for me, it just brings back, it's home.
So she was on your wall when you were growing up?
Yes.
And if you went to a friend's house, she was there as well?
She was there.
Everywhere you went?
Yes.
So who was Tutu?
I think Tutu is said to have been a princess, a Yoruba princess, who apparently Benoît was very keen on and who sat for him. And it was particularly interesting at the time because it was a cross-cultural romance.
Yeah.
Tutu was Yoruba, Benoît was Igbo. And even that, I think, is that tension I quite like. And I like to think, now that I know that story, that tension is in the painting. There's a sense of, I can never fully own, I can never fully sort of, you know...
Were they lovers?
I don't know.
So nobody knows the real story. There are a lot of mysteries.
Yes.
and rumours.
Yes.
And people imagining what this relationship might be.
Yes.
So that's the beauty of this painting, that you can read your own stories and your imagination can run riot when you look at her.
Yes. She's regal. So she's, you can tell from the way she's dressed, the headgear, and even just the way she carries the sort of the straightness of her back. You can see the princess in her.
And what do we know about Benoît then? He died in 1994 and he was greatly influenced, I think, by a lot of Western artists, wasn't he?
He was. He's one of those artists, Nigerian artists, who there's sort of a, in some ways like the painting, I think there's a bit of mystery about him. People have different, you know, so you say the name Benoît, people have really interesting and different stories about him. And a story that I love is the story about how he would fast for days before he would sort of start painting, or he was also a sculptor. And the story about how sometimes he would decide that this particular piece of art was not for sale. And so he's said to have sold a piece of art to an expatriate. And then the next day, suddenly decided, no, actually, I don't want to sell it. So he sort of ran off to the airport. The expatriate was about to board a flight. And he stopped the expatriate, gave him back his money and took back his art.
I've read that he, as I say, he was influenced by Western artists, Picasso he cites, and he reminds people that, of course, Picasso was greatly influenced at a certain point in his career by a lot of African art.
Yes.
And he says that, of course, nobody criticises Picasso for that, so why should he not, in turn, be looking at the Western canon?
Absolutely, and I think he makes a wonderful point about how being an African artist can often mean that people want you to do exactly what your ancestors did. So if you're not sort of copying bronze masks, then somehow you're not authentically African. And, you know, and I think that's a very good point. And also I love how he says that Picasso was influenced by his ancestors, by Benoît's ancestors.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's strange to then claim that he's being influenced by Picasso, because really, Picasso's influence came from his Benoît's ancestors, which I think is a fantastic point.
So you grew up with Tutu on your wall as a child. Is she still there with you now, or a different version of her?
She's still in my parents'
What about your house or wherever you live?
No, I don't have Tutu. Actually, you know, now that you mention it, I'm going to get myself a Tutu. But there's a sense in which, because Tutu represents childhood for me, I kind of like the idea of when I go to visit my parents, Tutu is there.
And yet, the original painting is missing.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
I find that I'm drawn to art that somehow peaks of home, particularly when I'm nostalgic and homesick. So this painting, Tutu, is, and by the way, apparently the original is missing. Nobody knows where it is. It's this wonderful mystery about, you know, where is the original Tutu? And nobody knows. Benoît was very well known, very well respected. And so this particular painting, Tutu, the print, I think, hung on every wall of every middle-class family in Eastern Nigeria when I was growing up. So I grew up with Tutu on the wall in the living room.
And it's a painting of a very beautiful-looking woman wearing a headscarf and turning and looking almost over her shoulder past the viewer.
Yes.
And there's an enigmatic kind
of
looking.
Yes, so there's just a beautiful sense of mystery about her. And it's also the kind of mystery that's, it's very compelling, but you can't quite penetrate. She keeps you away in a way. And growing up, I just love to stare at it. And now, for me, it just brings back, it's home.
So she was on your wall when you were growing
up? Yes.
And if you went to a friend's house, she was there as well?
She was there.
Everywhere you went?
Yes.
So who was Tutu?
I think Tutu is said to have been a princess, a Yoruba princess, who apparently Ben Nwomo was very keen on and who sat for him. And it was particularly interesting at the time because it was a cross-cultural romance. Yeah. Tutu was Yoruba, Ben Nwomo was Igbo. And even that, I think, is that tension I quite like. And I like to think, now that I know that story, that tension is in the painting. There's a sense of, I can never fully own, I can never fully sort of, you know...
Were they lovers?
I don't know.
So nobody knows the real story. There are a lot of mysteries.
Yes.
And rumours.
Yes.
And people imagining what this relationship might be.
Yes.
So that's the beauty of this painting, that you can read your own stories and your imagination can run riot when you look at her.
Yes. She's regal. So she's, you can tell from the way she's dressed, the headgear, and even just the way she carries the sort of the straightness of her back. You can see the princess in her.
And what do we know about Ben Onwenu then? He died in 1994 and he was greatly influenced, I think, by a lot of Western artists, wasn't he?
He was. He's one of those artists, Nigerian artists, who there's sort of a, in some ways like the painting, I think there's a bit of mystery about him. People have different, you know, so you say the name Ben Onwenu, people have really interesting and different stories about him. And a story that I love is the story about how he would fast for days before he would sort of start painting, or he was also a sculptor. And the story about how sometimes he would decide that this particular piece of art was not for sale. And so he's said to have sold a piece of art to an expatriate. And then the next day, suddenly decided, no, actually, I don't want to sell it. So he sort of ran off to the airport. The expatriate was about to board a flight. And he stopped the expatriate, gave him back his money and took back his art.
I've read that he, as I say, he was influenced by Western artists. Picasso, he cites. And he reminds people that, of course, Picasso was greatly influenced at a certain point in his career by a lot of African art.
Yes.
And he says that, of course, nobody criticises Picasso for that. So why should he not, in turn, be looking at the Western canon?
Absolutely. And I think he makes a wonderful point about how being an African artist can often mean that people want you to do exactly what your ancestors did. So if you're not sort of copying bronze masks, then somehow you're not authentically African. And, you know, and I think that's a very good point. And also I love how he says that Picasso was influenced by his ancestors, by Ben Nwomo's ancestors. Yeah. Therefore, it's strange to then claim that he's being influenced by Picasso, because really, Picasso's influence came from his Ben Nwomo's ancestors, which I think is a fantastic point.
So you grew up with Tutu on your wall as a child. Is she still there with you now, or a different version of her?
She's still in my parents' house,
What about your house, or wherever you live?
No, I don't have Tutu. Actually, you know, now that you mention it, I'm going to get myself a Tutu. But there's a sense in which, because Tutu represents childhood for me, I kind of like the idea of when I go to visit my parents, Tutu is there.
And yet, the original painting is missing.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 1.
At this point, the best question we can ask is, are there any developed countries left that still believe in open borders and globalization? Well, the answer to that question is yes, there are. And in the video today, we're going to be looking at one of the most significant of those countries.
Canada's openness.
In the year 2016 alone, Canada admitted to its country more than 300,000 immigrants. That is close to 1% of Canada's total population. Further, this is a greater portion than any other developed country. And do note here that this is nothing new. This is something that's been going on for two decades.
Extract 2.
The result of this is that today, one in every five Canadians was born abroad. This is a percentage that is almost double that of the US and the UK. And the fact of the matter is that this hasn't led to any sort of national tragedy. In fact, quite the opposite, and Canadians well know this. According to the prestigious Environics Institute, most citizens, almost 80% of them, consider immigration to be good for the economy and think that it is one of the best ways to deal with some of the issues facing Canada, such as its aging population. If you really think about it, it does make sense. Employment is the country's most productive asset, so why would they want to prevent it from growing? In the context of a dynamic economy, what's the harm of immigrants who are willing to work, who are willing to set up companies, and want to get an education? It is something that we at Visual Politic think is actually pretty good.
Extract 3.
In 2015, Justin Trudeau became Canada's Prime Minister. He defeated, against all odds, the Conservative Stephen Harper. Harper had held the office for almost 10 years. Since then, the political agenda has been dominated by a determination to deepen the country's pro-globalization policies. Trudeau himself, a left-winger, has been quite an advocate of promoting free trade and social mobility. In his first year, he signed a free trade agreement with the European Union and confirmed Canada's adherence to the TPP. Although Trump's first action in office was to destroy the TPP, it was going to be the biggest commercial agreement in history. In just a year, Canada has built up free trade agreements with nearly 60% of the global economy. Further, Trudeau wants to expand this and increase trade with China.
Extract 4.
And the government is doing more of the same concerning immigration. They've even set the goal of increasing the number of immigrants they get by 50% every single year. Given these principles, it probably shouldn't surprise you to learn that Canada is one of the countries that are most committed to receiving Syrian refugees. Canada has received more than 33,000 Syrian refugees since Trudeau took office. In his first year, Trudeau himself went to Toronto's airport to welcome the refugees into the country.
Extract 5.
Hold on a second, because immigration to Canada isn't totally free. In fact, it's not as free as we at Visual Politic would like. But what's really important here is not whether or whether there are not excessive administrative difficulties, but rather that citizens shouldn't automatically view those who are immigrating to the country as criminals. And this is precisely why Canada is so successful. They are a country that takes pride in looking for additional citizens. They are not looking for temporary immigrants. Since 1967, immigration to Canada has been based on a points system. This system considers qualifications, experience, professional skills, and a knowledge of either French or English. In the same way, the system also gives priority to those who are needed by Canada's companies. Canada.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 1.
At this point, the best question we can ask is, are there any developed countries left that still believe in open borders and globalization? Well, the answer to that question is yes, there are. And in the video today, we're going to be looking at one of the most significant of those countries.
Canada's openness.
In the year 2016 alone, Canada admitted to its country more than 300,000 immigrants. That is close to 1% of Canada's total population. Further, this is a greater portion than any other developed country. And do note here that this is nothing new. This is something that's been going on for two decades.
Extract 2.
The result of this is that today, one in every five Canadians was born abroad. This is a percentage that is almost double that of the US and the UK. And the fact of the matter is that this hasn't led to any sort of national tragedy. In fact, quite the opposite, and Canadians well know this. According to the prestigious Environics Institute, most citizens, almost 80% of them, consider immigration to be good for the economy and think that it is one of the best ways to deal with some of the issues facing Canada, such as its aging population. If you really think about it, it does make sense. Employment is the country's most productive asset, so why would they want to prevent it from growing? In the context of a dynamic economy, what's the harm of immigrants who are willing to work, who are willing to set up companies, and want to get an education? It is something that we at Visual Politic think is actually pretty good.
Extract 3.
In 2015, Justin Trudeau became Canada's Prime Minister. He defeated, against all odds, the Conservative Stephen Harper. Harper had held the office for almost 10 years. Since then, the political agenda has been dominated by a determination to deepen the country's pro-globalization policies. Trudeau himself, a left-winger, has been quite an advocate of promoting free trade and social mobility. In his first year, he signed a free trade agreement with the European Union and confirmed Canada's adherence to the TPP. Although Trump's first action in office was to destroy the TPP, it was going to be the biggest commercial agreement in history. In just a year, Canada has built up free trade agreements with nearly 60% of the global economy. Further, Trudeau wants to expand this and increase trade with China.
Extract 4.
And the government is doing more of the same concerning immigration. They've even set the goal of increasing the number of immigrants they get by 50% every single year. Given these principles, it probably shouldn't surprise you to learn that Canada is one of the countries that are most committed to receiving Syrian refugees. Canada has received more than 33,000 Syrian refugees since Trudeau took office. In his first year, Trudeau himself went to Toronto's airport to welcome the refugees into the country.
Extract 5.
Hold on a second, because immigration to Canada isn't totally free. In fact, it's not as free as we at Visual Politic would like. But what's really important here is not whether or whether there are not excessive administrative difficulties, but rather that citizens shouldn't automatically view those who are immigrating to the country as criminals. And this is precisely why Canada is so successful. They are a country that takes pride in looking for additional citizens. They are not looking for temporary immigrants. Since 1967, immigration to Canada has been based on a points system. This system considers qualifications, experience, professional skills, and a knowledge of either French or English. In the same way, the system also gives priority to those who are needed by Canada's companies. Canada.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 1.
At this point, the best question we can ask is, are there any developed countries left that still believe in open borders and globalization? Well, the answer to that question is yes, there are. And in the video today, we're going to be looking at one of the most significant of those countries.
Canada's openness.
In the year 2016 alone, Canada admitted to its country more than 300,000 immigrants. That is close to 1% of Canada's total population. Further, this is a greater portion than any other developed country. And do note here that this is nothing new. This is something that's been going on for two decades.
Extract 2.
The result of this is that today, one in every five Canadians was born abroad. This is a percentage that is almost double that of the US and the UK. And the fact of the matter is that this hasn't led to any sort of national tragedy. In fact, quite the opposite, and Canadians well know this. According to the prestigious Environics Institute, most citizens, almost 80% of them, consider immigration to be good for the economy and think that it is one of the best ways to deal with some of the issues facing Canada, such as its aging population. If you really think about it, it does make sense. Employment is the country's most productive asset, so why would they want to prevent it from growing? In the context of a dynamic economy, what's the harm of immigrants who are willing to work, who are willing to set up companies, and want to get an education? It is something that we at Visual Politic think is actually pretty good.
Extract 3.
In 2015, Justin Trudeau became Canada's Prime Minister. He defeated, against all odds, the Conservative Stephen Harper. Harper had held the office for almost 10 years. Since then, the political agenda has been dominated by a determination to deepen the country's pro-globalization policies. Trudeau himself, a left-winger, has been quite an advocate of promoting free trade and social mobility. In his first year, he signed a free trade agreement with the European Union and confirmed Canada's adherence to the TPP. Although Trump's first action in office was to destroy the TPP, it was going to be the biggest commercial agreement in history. In just a year, Canada has built up free trade agreements with nearly 60% of the global economy. Further, Trudeau wants to expand this and increase trade with China.
Extract 4.
And the government is doing more of the same concerning immigration. They've even set the goal of increasing the number of immigrants they get by 50% every single year. Given these principles, it probably shouldn't surprise you to learn that Canada is one of the countries that are most committed to receiving Syrian refugees. Canada has received more than 33,000 Syrian refugees since Trudeau took office. In his first year, Trudeau himself went to Toronto's airport to welcome the refugees into the country.
Extract 5.
Hold on a second, because immigration to Canada isn't totally free. In fact, it's not as free as we at Visual Politic would like. But what's really important here is not whether or whether there are not excessive administrative difficulties, but rather that citizens shouldn't automatically view those who are immigrating to the country as criminals. And this is precisely why Canada is so successful. They are a country that takes pride in looking for additional citizens. They are not looking for temporary immigrants. Since 1967, immigration to Canada has been based on a points system. This system considers qualifications, experience, professional skills, and a knowledge of either French or English. In the same way, the system also gives priority to those who are needed by Canada's companies. Canada.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.